Anti-Semitism should be confronted when it begins, when it shows its first signs. Otherwise, anti-Semitism can metastasize into monstrous dimensions.
Erinnerung an den Holocaust hat viele Facetten. Sie steht nicht nur für sich selbst, sondern sie ist auch Fundament unserer demokratischen Zivilgesellschaft. Weltweit spielt die internationale Holocaust-Gedenkstätte Yad Vashem dabei die wohl zentralste Rolle. Deshalb freuen wir uns besonders über den heutigen Gesprächspartner für unseren Podcast Zukunft durch Erinnerung. Dani Dayan, seit einem Jahr Vorstandsvorsitzender von Yad Vashem. Sein Lebenslauf ist vielfältig und global. Als Unternehmer, Politiker, Aktivist und Diplomat. Ebenso vielfältig sind die Themen. Hören Sie selbst. Dani Dayan, welcome to our podcast. We're very glad and very grateful you're taking the time to speak to us. Because you actually do have a very full calendar. Pretty much a year ago, you were appointed chairman of Yad Vashem. And since the official memorial to Holocaust victim was founded in 1953, you're only the third person to hold this position. So in a nutshell, how was your first year and how was onboarding during the pandemic?
Well, my first year was very busy and exciting. Obviously, in my first year in office, one of my main business was to try to shape the new vision for Yad Vashem. Yet we are in the brink of a new era in Holocaust remembrance. We are in the brink of an era in which I call the post-survivors era. Unfortunately, but also inevitably, in some years, I hope a large number of years, but I am also realistic, the burden of being witnesses will be on our shoulders and not in the shoulders of the actual witnesses. So we have to rethink the strategy for Holocaust remembrance, and as a result of that, also the strategy for Yad Vashem. But, you know, I can think of only a handful of missions that I see as more important than this one. When I returned 2 years ago from New York, where I served for 4 years as a senior Israeli diplomat there as the consul general to New York, there were really very few missions that I would have taken after that exciting one of representing the Jewish state to the largest Jewish community outside of Israel, or as I sometimes used to tell Mayor de Blasio of New York, to represent the capital of the world, Jerusalem, to the city that believes that is the capital of the world, New York. So there were not many missions that you would have taken after that. But when the government asked me to take the leadership of Yad Vashem, that is one mission that if you are a person with a deep Jewish historical conscience like I am, you can't refuse.
You were born in Buenos Aires and you moved to Israel with your parents in 1971, aged 15. Do you remember your first visit to Yad Vashem?
Well, my first visit to Yad Vashem was shortly after I arrived to Israel, but it was a completely different Yad Vashem, what we call here the old museum, the pre-2005 museum, obviously. Since then, it changed dramatically. I have to credit my two predecessors that you hinted to them, Yitzhak Tolka Arad, that unfortunately passed away a year ago, a little bit more, and Avner Shalev, that fortunately is with us and active and participates in some activities of Yad Vashem. They really converted the old Yad Vashem into a completely new and modern and challenging organization. I would say that they infused spirit in what was previously a bunch of monuments with an archive. And now it's education and research and all over the world. And, you know, that only increases the feeling of responsibility over my shoulders that I feel every day when I come to Yad Vashem.
You are the first chairman of Yad Vashem to be born after the end of the Holocaust. And you already mentioned the post-survivor era. What does that mean for you personally?
Well, indeed, not only I was born after the war, I was born very far from the places in which the war and the Shoah took place in South America. Nevertheless, the Shoah was always, always, omnipresent in my mind. It was one of the shaping factors of my being an adult person. You know, I sometimes say that I was born thanks to Ukrainian anti-Semitism, because the pogroms of the 19... My father was a native of Kiev in 1920, and we tend to forget that those were terrible days for Jews of Ukraine. Some 50,000 Jews were murdered in pogroms by Ukrainian nationalists and others during that time. They fled Ukraine to Argentina, first to Poland and then to Argentina. So otherwise, if they wouldn't have escaped Europe because of anti-Semitism, my family would have been there during the Shoah. And we all understand what does it mean. Actually, two of my dad's uncles that stayed in Poland, in an area of Poland that today is part of Ukraine, were shot to death in the shooting pits of Valkovich.
There's another first when it comes to you and Yad Vashem. You're the first former politician to be shaman. And I read you're sort of a self-described Zionist, a national, a liberal, a secular Jew and Israeli. You also were a long-time activist and head of the right-wing settler movement, Yesha Council. So I'm sure you read it. The newspaper Haaretz a year ago, when you commented upon your appointment, quote, "This is the final step toward politicizing Yad Vashem," end of quote. And Yad Vashem is, of course, a nonpartisan organization. So how do you separate your previous political life and your sort of ongoing political beliefs?
Yeah, I must correct you. It's not Haaretz that wrote to that. It's a person that published an article in Haaretz. I think okay. That even within Haaretz, which is a very liberal newspaper, left-leaning newspaper, I think my appointment as chairman at Yad Vashem was welcome. First of all, you know, I create a firewall between politics and Yad Vashem. The moment I enter the gates, I pass every morning when I pass the gates of Yad Vashem, of the entrance to Yad Vashem, I check my politics there. But, you know, I think that in all my positions, and even more so in my term as Israel's Consul General in New York, I proved more than once, multiple opportunities, that I am a true liberal, a true believer in freedom of speech and freedom of thought, in engaging with different perspectives. And actually, I am being accused in the Israeli media lately by some right-wing elements of being too progressive. So, you know, I think that for my entire public life, I have been a person that is not only difficult, I would say that is impossible to compartmentalize me, to put me in a box of cliches and say if he believes X on one thing, for sure he believes Y in another thing. My entire life have been very zealous of my freedom and my privilege to be unconventional.
Mm-hmm. And that explains why other Israeli left-wingers, some of you you just mentioned, despite political differences, very much accepted your appointment.
I must add that my appointment was promoted, among others, by current Prime Minister Yair Lapid. I would say that from wall to wall, Oped in Haaretz being the exception that proves the rule.
And that is particularly because people praise from all sides of the political spectrum praise your willingness to build bridges and value your diplomatic demeanor. What I wonder is, for you as a former diplomat, at what point does the time come for you to stop being diplomatic?
When I was in diplomacy, in many occasions in which outrageous things were being said about my country, about truth, I know how to be undiplomatic, even how to be nasty. But if we are talking about my current position in Yad Vashem, I have zero tolerance for anti-Semitism. I have zero tolerance for Holocaust denial. I have zero tolerance for Holocaust distortion. And I think I already proved it in my last year in Yad Vashem, for instance, when outrageous statement by the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov. That was a blatant anti-Semitic statement. I reacted very angrily and very clearly. I must tell you that even 2 weeks ago, criticized harshly certain statement by a Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. And here you have a scoop. I received immediately, 2 days later, a letter by Prime Minister Orban accusing me of not distorting his words and his intentions. But, you know, in addition to the fact that we are talking about, it also shows the relevance of Yad Vashem. There were many critics of what Prime Minister Orban said about mixing races, and he answered Yad Vashem because the moral authority that Yad Vashem in the world is second to none.
Do you yet know what you're going to answer?
I answered. I stood by my words that the vocabulary Mr. Orban used in that speech about the mixing races is a vocabulary reminiscent of a dark era in the history that Yad Vashem is charged with remembering it and making sure it doesn't happen again. I didn't apologize for my words of criticism.
So you mentioned Lavrov, you mentioned President Orban. The natural sort of follow-up question is, this year's art exhibition Documenta in the German town of Kassel, which sort of self-defines as the most important art show in the world, had a massive anti-Semitism scandal, which is actually still ongoing. And for those who sort of didn't take note of it, it was blatant and quite horrific displays of anti-Semitism. Jews depicted with vampire teeth and Israeli soldiers shown as pigs, all of that in the public sphere. The artists weren't from Germany, but the people in charge were and are, and they had it coming because there had been warning after warning by Jewish organizations. And nothing or next to nothing was actually done by the executive to prevent this from happening, which isn't surprising if you see certain links of senior officials with the BDS movement. So I'm sure you followed this sort of cultural catastrophe, but so far I think you haven't commented on it.
Sometimes we find in the situation that we miss a statement on this, on that, but I will tell you what I tell the leaders of the world that come to Yad Vashem, the dignitaries of the world that come to Yad Vashem. I told that President Biden, I told that Chancellor Scholz when he was here recently. Then the Shoah has many lessons, innumerable. Some lessons are personal, some are national, some are universal. And I don't believe in indoctrination. I don't believe there is one lesson that everyone has to agree with. I believe that as long as those lessons are learned by decent persons, all of them are legitimate. Some of them are even contradictory. I will give you an example. For instance, our current chairman of our council is Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, the former chief rabbi of Israel, a Buchenwald survivor. His predecessor was Yosef Lapid, the father of Prime Minister Lapid, a former minister of justice and a survivor of the Budapest ghetto. Yosef Lapid, or Tommy Lapid, that was usually called, his lesson from the Shoah is that God doesn't exist. And Rabbi Lau's lessons that we have to dedicate our life to God. So who I am to judge. But that being said, I am entitled to my lessons. And one of my lessons that I never miss an opportunity to mention that, to share them with the leaders of the world that come to Yad Vashem, is the following. Anti-Semitism should be confronted when it begins, when it shows its first signs. Otherwise, anti-Semitism can metastasize into monstrous dimensions. I'm not implying that we are now these days in Europe of the 1930s. No, we are far from it, thank God. But there is one difference between us and the generation of the 1930s, Jewish generation and non-Jewish generation. And the difference is that we have experience that they didn't have. Probably they thought, okay, they burn books, they draw cartoons presenting the Jews as vampires or as pigs, but they will not burn people. Well, we know they can burn also people, human beings. So we don't have the privilege to underestimate anti-Semitism. And, you know, in the context of Documenta, but not only in that context, if you act against anti-Semitism immediately, forcefully, and I say especially immediately, then you can come to Yad Vashem and say never again. But if you don't, then when you say never again, you convert that into a shallow cliche and not something that you really have the right to say it here in Yad Vashem.
If we move a little further down the map in Europe to Rome, where you recently met the Pope, you both share Argentinian roots. What was that meeting like for you?
First of all, it was another proof of the relevance and importance of Yad Vashem. I asked for that meeting the Apostolic Nuncio, the Vatican ambassador to Israel, and it was granted almost immediately in the highest format existing, a private audience in the chambers of the Pope. Second, it was for me a personal experience, really extremely emotional. As you said, we are both from Buenos Aires, Argentina. Both of us were born in Buenos Aires, Argentina. We spoke in Spanish, I would say in the special Buenos Aires dialect of Spanish that is somewhat different from the Spanish of Spain or other areas of Latin America. Actually, you know, the first thing that we did when we started our conversation was to fire the translator that the Vatican prepared for our meeting. But now, substantively, that was an extremely important meeting. I thank the Pope Francis, for opening the archives of the Vatican for our researchers and for our archive. And he said something that I think is very important. He said, the church is not afraid of history. And whatever you will find on those archives is the truth, and we should confront the truth. He also said that, you know, he didn't try to use some theological rhetoric that probably he could have and claim that everything that the church did is right. No, he said the opposite. He said, I know that in the church, like in any other place, in the Catholic Church, there are good people and not so good people. There are people that do the right thing and did the right thing, and people that do not do the right thing and did not do the right thing. I think that is very significant, not trying to hide behind a theological shield. And the other thing, that he was very outspoken against anti-Semitism and in favor of Holocaust remembrance. And I think that the prominence, the great publicity that the Vatican media gave in many languages, including Arabic, to that meeting is a sign that he means it. I bid him farewell. He told me, never forget that you have a friend here, an ally. And I think that he meant not just, you know, on a personal level, because I doubt if I will see the Pope again, but he meant, I am sure, that we have a friend and an ally in the battle against anti-Semitism and in the battle for Holocaust remembrance.
I'm not a Catholic, but from what I hear of other people who visited the Pope, that he sometimes hands out gifts like rosaries or a Bible. Did he give you anything as a farewell?
Yes, of course. He gave me a metal olive branch in a beautiful white case with the emblem of the Pope and a personal dedication for me. I gave him a gift, obviously. I brought him a replica of an ornament, of a decoration of a Torah ark, a part of Romania that today belongs to Ukraine, that we saved, actually. We brought to Yad Vashem the original, because the synagogue was intact, but there were no Jews left. So in the 90s, we did an effort to bring to Yad Vashem many of those artifacts. They are today in our synagogue. 10 commandments are depicted in that tablet that I gave the Pope. You know, the Pope also has a great sense of humor. We were asked to bring the present in advance a few hours earlier, and we did. But when we arrived to the Vatican, to the Apostolic Palace to see the Pope, they couldn't find it. And there were a few tense moments of embarrassment. And when I entered the chambers of the Pope, I thought that they lost it. So I apologized to the Pope. I told him, Your Holiness, I'm sorry I brought this and this, but they can't find it. And the Pope looked at me and smiled and said, oh, I know, someone here in the Vatican already took it and sold it to the antiquities shop in downtown Rome. So go find it there. But fortunately, they find it before the end of our meeting, and I was able to present it to the Pope.
From my outside view, I assume that meetings such as these are sort of the nicer side of your position, which isn't an easy one, obviously. So what does a day at the office look like for you?
I don't think that there are two similar days. Administering, managing an organization like Yad Vashem, a vast organization, occupies a part of my schedule, but there is an incessant stream of dignitaries and diplomats. The last one was the new German ambassador to Israel that came to see me, and people from all over the world that have ideas, have bring things to Yad Vashem that want to share. But and also, you know, my traveling schedule. I was a keynote speaker recently at the Latin American Forum Against Antisemitism in my native Buenos Aires, and I had a very interesting meeting with the president of Argentina, Alberto Fernandez. I signed two agreements, one with the Minister of Education of Argentina and the other with the Minister of the Interior, who is in charge of the National Archives of Argentina, of exchange of archival documents, and participated in the commemoration of the 28th anniversary of the attack on the AMIA building, the Jewish community building in Buenos Aires. We'll visit Austria. I will sign with the chancellor, an agreement of cooperation between the federal government and Yad Vashem, also a quite generous contribution of the Austrian government of 1.5 million euros to Yad Vashem for projects that are related to Austria. I will sign with the Minister of Education an agreement on education, and with the President of the Austrian Parliament also an agreement. It's quite a busy schedule. And in the meantime, obviously, we had the privilege of hosting here President Biden of mm-hmm. the United States in a very moving visit.
Forgive me for asking, but your work basically means that you're surrounded by history every day, and basically the worst part of human history, by all the things humans can do and have done to other humans, by the suffering, the death of 6 million Jews. How does that affect you when you go home and in your free time? Can you sort of block that out? You mentioned you had immediate family that was killed, that was murdered during the Holocaust. How do you, well, relax wouldn't be the right word, but...
It's not easy, but you understand that you are in a mission that has to be done. You know, it's not only about me, it's about the entire staff of Yad Vashem that we pay a toll. No doubt we pay a toll for working in a place that is dedicated, as you said, the most horrific chapter in human history. I visited recently Auschwitz to speak at the 75th anniversary of the Auschwitz Museum. And it wasn't my first visit to Auschwitz, but it was my first visit as chairman of Yad Vashem. In Birkenau, I saw a few steps that go down to was the gas chambers and the crematorium, that horrific production line of murder that is now crumbled and doesn't exist anymore. But the steps are there, and I thought that those three or four steps, actually they descend to the lowest point in Earth, to the lowest point humanity. There are only four steps, but they descend to the lowest point humanity ever reached. I am surrounded by it, but we create the methods to overcome that. My first day in office, August 23rd, 2021. The second thing that I did is to tour the campus of Yad Vashem. The first was to meet two Holocaust survivors that still work in Yad Vashem. When I was touring the campus, I visited the Holocaust Art Museum. Not many people are aware that we have an art museum and the largest collection in the world of Holocaust-related art. And at the exit of, by the way, this is by itself mind-boggling, that when the Nazis tried to deprive the Jews from any resemblance of humanity. There were artists that continued to make art. That's incredible. One of them was Gelas Ekstein. Gelas Ekstein was a Jewish-Polish painter in the ghetto, in the Warsaw ghetto. She continued to make art at the beginning with canvas and colors, and then she didn't have any canvases and any colors, just drawings on paper. And she hid some of her works of art in what later became known as the Ringelblum Archive that was recovered after the war. But not only her paintings and her drawings she put there, she also put there her last will. She wrote her last will in Yiddish. And a part of it, a quote from that document, is on a wall in our art museum beside her works. And she says there that, I know I am doomed, I will not survive. She writes this in August 1st, 1942. I know I will not survive, and indeed she didn't. She was killed, her husband was killed, her three-year-old daughter was killed. But she says, I bequeath my art, my works of art, to the Jewish Museum that will be established after the war. And then I saw this and I thought, she means Yad Vashem. I mean, she knew in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942, barely days before her death, in her last will, she's telling us, establish Yad Vashem. And suddenly I understood the responsibility I have on my shoulders to fulfill her will and the will of 6 million others. My first decision as chairman of Yad Vashem was that moment. I decided to put that quote on a wall in my office. So this is the first thing I see every morning when I come to Yad Vashem, the last thing I see every evening before I leave Yad Vashem, and that reminds me, if I ever forget, why I am here. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a lot of strength. A lot of motivation.
Your position comes with enormous responsibilities. Some of whom you've just mentioned. What are the skills that you think are essential for succeeding in your job? And how does the fact that you're actually a tech entrepreneur help you fulfilling your new role?
The basic thing that you need is values. And to be what I call the historically conscious. For me, Jewish history, history in general, but I must admit that in particular Jewish history, is not something that is just written in the books. It's something that I live. Jewish historians, as you mentioned, that I am not a particularly observant person. I always say, and now I am talking about the referring to what I just said about Tommy Lapid and the Rabbi Lau, I sometimes say that my relationship with God is one of the things that I live to examine after I retire, but always conscious of Jewish history. I think that's probably without that is impossible to be chairman of Yad Vashem. Actually, when I went to my graduate studies, that I had a dilemma. I was already a quite successful entrepreneur. I could allow myself to. I had this dilemma whether to learn to study finance, as I unfortunately decided to do, or Jewish history for my soul. Probably I will still one day go back to school to learn Jewish history, but now in some sense I'm doing it. So I think that's probably the most important thing. You need, sensitivity to history, interest in history, and understanding that history is not something that is only relevant for studies, but is extremely relevant for the present and for the future.
You already mentioned when we were talking about your visit to the Pope, some of the artifacts that have been taken to Yad Vashem. Earlier this year, the Freundeskreis, the Friends of Yad Vashem in Germany, together with Yad Vashem and the Central a council of Jews in Germany launched the campaign Licht zeigen, show light. And for those listeners who missed it, it commemorated the iconic photograph of the Posner family's Chanukah menorah, which stood on a windowsill with, you know, the picture with the Nazi headquarters in Kiel with the swastika flags in the background across the street. In a message, when you were asked to sort of comment on that campaign, you emphasized the specific value of personal objects and artifacts for Holocaust remembrance. What significance do those objects hold for you? And is there a particular one that is sort of that stands out for you personally?
Well, first of all, I have to commend the Freudenkreis for doing that. It was an original, a significant way to spread the word, to remember the Holocaust. As you know, that will be also a prologue for a much larger thing that we plan in the Bundestag in January 2023 to bring 16 artifacts, 16 different artifacts from our original artifacts from our collection, one from each lander, and they will be exhibited in the Bundestag in January 2023, ahead of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27. But the Shoah is a well-known quote that the Shoah, the Holocaust, is not only the assassination of 6 million Jews, but is 6 million assassinations in which in each one of them was murdered one Jew. And that's the reason we, in Yad Vashem, deal with the wood, the Shoah, but also with each one of the trees, which one of the individuals we painstakingly research for names and pictures of the victims and personal data, etc., etc. But to that famous quote, I add a third part that is sometimes neglected, but it is also the erasure from the face of earth of thousands of Jewish communities. The community level is very important for me. And the Freudenkreis project in Kiel combined the personal story of one family, but it was also about the community, the Jewish community of Kiel. Like in Kiel, there were, as I said, thousands of communities, some of them prosperous, some of them very poor, some of them rural, some of them urban, with a thriving Jewish life for millennia that we have to commemorate. At a certain point, I realized that in Israel today, since a certain museum changed its character, a certain museum in Tel Aviv, there is no commemoration of the communities that were lost, the Jewish communities, that the Jewish life, Jewish culture that was lost in the Holocaust. So we are planning, we have a very ambitious plan in our area of Yad Vashem that is called the Valley of Communities, to do something there, an educational center and probably also an audiovisual program to remember the life, the communities that were lost, not only the overall Jewish people, not only the individuals, but the community life. I think it's extremely important. And the project in Kiel combine it because it was a community project.
I think you haven't come to Germany so far. Would a project such as bringing those communities into the forefront of remembrance, would there be a reason for you to come to Germany?
Yes, you're right. I didn't visit Germany. And it's not a coincidence, I mean, that I didn't. It was a decision that I took at a very early stage in my life. That was a way for me to remember that, you know, in Jewish houses for many centuries, it was a tradition that you leave a part of your home unpainted. You don't paint it, and it was a way to remember the destruction of Jerusalem. A symbolic way, you see that and you remember that Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. In the same sense, that was my decision, that I want something to always remember that we suffered such a tragedy, such a catastrophe. You cannot change history. I wish we could, but we know that we cannot change history. So in some sense, what is relevant today I started to understand what your people did in the past, but how you confront that past today. And I must say that the way Germany confronts its past is mostly remarkable. I saw Chancellor Merkel here, I saw Chancellor Scholz here, and I saw many others. Yes, I made a decision that, yes, of course, I will come for the opening of the exhibition. Probably I will come even earlier if there is not still, probably during Hanukkah, there will be an event related to that specific Hanukkah, to that specific menorah that you mentioned. And I will come again in March for the opening in the Museum of Photography of Berlin of our Flashes of Memory exhibition, that is a remarkable exhibition of photographs, and that it has three chapters, photographs taken by the Nazis, photographs taken by Jews, and photographs taken by the liberating armies. So when it opens in March in the Museum of Photography in Berlin, I probably will come again.
You mentioned when talking about how Germany deals with its past that it was mostly done well. So let's talk about the part that isn't mostly done well. There's a well-known German Jewish journalist, Henrik M. Bruder, who recently said in an interview that in Germany, the benchmark for anti-Semitism basically is the Holocaust and 6 million murdered Jews, meaning that anything below that, like modern day anti-Semitism, dressed in many, many costumes, is very often ignored or belittled, which helps our country to deal with Iran and in many, many other ways. So you mentioned that a lot of dignitaries, political dignitaries, come to see Yad Vashem. Is there anything specific you tell the German dignitaries that you told Stefan Seibert, the new ambassador to Israel, who used to be government spokesman? Do you make a difference between the Germans you meet in your role and other dignitaries from all over the world?
There is no doubt that the responsibility of Germany is different, in a completely different level. We are very adamant in pressuring countries to look into their past candidly, with sincerity. It's not always an easy task. I remember going to Ukraine in October 2021 for the 80th commemoration of the massacre in Babi Yar, and I opened a seminar there, and there were Ukrainian officials, and I told them very clearly, we embrace you into the family, welcome you into the family of democratic nations, and we are very grateful that Ukraine, contrary to the Soviet Union, acknowledged the Jewishness of the victims, but you still have to go the extra mile and recognize Ukrainian collaboration with the Nazis. Obviously, in Germany, it's even more significant. I must say that Germans do it. Germans look at their past with shame. Look at their past with horror, again, most of them, and recognize their special responsibility. Is everything perfect? No, of course not. Does it trickle down into the entire society that Germany is becoming a multicultural, multi-ethnic society? What does it mean to become a German citizen vis-a-vis the responsibility of Germany to its history? This is a question that was raised, by the way, by German officials here, not only by us, but by German officials. This is a whole range of issues. Again, as I said earlier, the Holocaust cannot be the benchmark. The benchmark should be initial signs of anti-Semitism. And yes, we saw it. Unfortunately, we saw the attack in Yom Kippur in the synagogue in Halle. We see anti-Semitism disguised as anti-Zionism, but is blatant anti-Semitism. We will always remind Germany that it has a special obligation.
How will you ensure that remembrance continues in times, you mentioned it earlier, where no direct Holocaust survivors will not be able to tell us about the horrors from their own personal experience, because in the foreseeable future, we will not have any Holocaust survivors left to tell us those stories?
I think that the Holocaust is such a vast event, a huge event, that it is remembered and it will continue to be remembered as such for a very, very long time. I see Holocaust awareness growing, actually, not diminishing. You know, Holocaust, International Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27th, that in Germany was earlier, but the world adopted it in the 21st century, not in the 20th century. It didn't exist in the 20th century. IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, more than 30 countries, governments allying to remember the Shoah, the Holocaust, and combat anti-Semitism through Holocaust remembrance, was established in the 21st century, didn't exist in the 20th century. A convention, a conference like the one that the former Prime Minister of Sweden convened in Malmö last November, didn't happen in the 20th century. Those things happened in the 21st century. So overall, I am encouraged that Holocaust remembrance is increasing. Holocaust awareness is increasing. Obviously, we have to continue to work to make sure that it is the case and it continues that. But in that sense, I see, you know, sometimes probably when we were too close to the event, it was difficult to confront it, to confront the horrific facts. I think that, you know, I will give you another example, the war in the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The usage in the war of propaganda, mainly by the Russian Federation, but sometimes also by Ukraine, of references to the Nazi regime and to the Holocaust. That means that it is very relevant even today. We have to make sure that it continues that way, not misusing in propaganda wars, but that the Shoah and the Nazi horror is something that is present in the international discourse.
So it seems you share Angela Merkel's optimism, which she displayed when she was last in Israel during her last state visit, and said that it fills me with optimism to know that our governments will continue the important remembrance of the Holocaust.
In some senses, I do. I must say that Angela Merkel, in her sixth visit as chancellor to Yad Vashem, was my first official visit that I hosted as chairman of Yad Vashem. Actually, it should have taken place earlier, before the election, but then came the takeover of Kabul in Afghanistan, and she couldn't travel, so she came after the election, but still as chancellor. She was here for almost 3 hours in Yad Vashem, in spite of the fact that she can be a guide in Yad Vashem. She knows the place very well. But she had a very unique request that I think was the first person that asked that, and we granted it to her, is to stay alone, completely alone, no security, no assistant, nothing, alone for 15 minutes in the museum. And I waited for her when she emerged out of those sliding doors to the panorama of Jerusalem. And in spite of the fact that it was her sixth visit to Yad Vashem as chancellor, she was visibly moved. When I see sincerity, I know it, and there was sincerity there.
Personally, I'm not sure I share your optimism, maybe in regard to all the mentions you made of official initiatives that have been adopted in this century. But I fear that particularly among younger generations, the awareness for anti-Semitism sort of fades into a general narrative of, well, we don't like racism, and this was sort of the persecution of Jews is not, let's say, something particularly special in history compared to colonialism, slavery, etc. Do you see that as a problem, or is that just a...
Well, you know, no doubt that the danger exists. I will give you an example from a well-known celebrity, Whoopi Goldberg, the Afro-American actress. And she said that the Holocaust is not about racism, because there were two white groups that were in a conflict. Obviously, that's nonsense. It was everything about race, not because it doesn't matter if the Jews are a race or not, but the Nazis saw it as a race. It was an entire racial theory in the basis of Nazism, not National Socialism. But there was no conflict between Jews and Germans. It was obviously a persecution, hatred, one-sided hatred. Now I ask myself, was that anti-Semitism? Is Whoopi Goldberg anti-Semitic? I don't know. Probably she is, but not. I don't think that specific statement is anti-Semitic. That statement was ignorant. It simply showed how deeply ignorant she is about the Holocaust. And I regretted terribly that her network decided to send her for 2 weeks at home. I think it would have been much more beneficial and much more relevant if they would have sent her for 2 weeks in Yad Vashem. Yeah, there is ignorance and there is a lot of things that, and there is this, as you mentioned, there's theories that conflate a lot of things together, and the notion that Jews are privileged, that there is one of the greatest nonsenses that only ignorance can attribute to Jews' privilege. Still, I believe that the awareness to the Holocaust, not always to the consequences of the Holocaust vis-a-vis anti-Semitism, but I feel that probably, as you said, I am optimistic, but I feel that the interest in the Holocaust and the awareness of the Holocaust is growing. I will give you another example. Holocaust denial. In the previous century, in the 70s, 80s, there was a rampant Holocaust denial, not just in the social media, that today you can't find Holocaust denial in the social media, no doubt. But today, a serious leader, intellectual, journalist will not deny that Auschwitz existed or the gas chambers, etc. We forget that in the previous century, in the 70s, 80s, there were intellectuals, so-called intellectuals, like David Irving, for instance, the famous trial against Deborah Lipstadt. That seems today almost impossible. But we see something no less troubling, that is Holocaust distortion. And Holocaust distortion is troubling because the main form of Holocaust distortion today is state-promoted. Countries that say, of course, Auschwitz happened and Babi Yar happened and the victims were Jews. But my countrymen, our countrymen, all of them tried to help the Jews. Well, unfortunately, that's a lie. In every single country that was under German occupation or influence, there were more collaborators than righteous, and for sure indifference. And that is a form of distortion that we see it also, not only, I mean, people when I say this think that I'm talking about Poland, and definitely Poland has a lot of explanations to do in that respect with their legislation, but also Belarus legislated a law in the Soviet type, talking about the genocide of the Belarusian people, and lately in Russia, in the Russian Federation, we report more talking about the genocide of Soviet citizens and not of Jews, instead of Jews. And you know, even in Western Europe, in France, there was quite prominent at some stages a presidential candidate, a Jew, I must say, Eric Zemmour, that whitewashed Vichy regime, saying that the Vichy regime helped save Jews, which is an historical fallacy. So this kind of distortion is very, very troubling.
In 2023, you will commemorate the founding of Yad Vashem 70 years ago. What are your plans for this very special year?
Well, first of all, we commemorate 70 years since the founding of Yad Vashem, the legislation of the Knesset in 1953. We will also commemorate 25 years of the Freudenkreis, which is also relevant to our conversation. We have many projects. You know that we have in Auschwitz, in the Israeli pavilion in Auschwitz, Block 27, that is of the State of Israel, but it was done and maintained by Yad Vashem. We have something that is called the Book of Names. It's not a book, it's a room with a very large installation that has in Auschwitz 4.2 million names of Jewish victims of the Shoah. We are building two additional copies. One will be permanently in Yad Vashem, and the other will travel the world and will be inaugurated in January 27, 2023, in the United Nations, that an agreement I reached with Secretary General Guterres that will open the commemoration of our 70th anniversary, exhibiting the Book of Names in the United Nations. We will have an exhibition in Berlin. In addition to the exhibition of the artifacts, we will open in the Museum of Photography in Berlin our Flashes of Memory exhibition. We will make an art exhibition first in Detroit, in the Art Museum of Detroit in Michigan, United States, and later in other places in the world. And we will continue our incessant work to tell the story. When I came to Yad Vashem as chairman, and as you mentioned, most of my life I was in the business world, in the information technology world. You know, people always told me, marketing people always told me, you need one message. So I said, let's think, what is the Yad Vashem's one message? To compare it with other Jewish events, you know, we have the festival of Pesach, of Passover, is about freedom. We have Chanukah, is about liberation. We have Tisha B'Av, is about destruction, exile. So what is the one word that encapsulates the Shoah? And very quickly understood that it's impossible. That the event is so large, so vast, so multifaceted, and the time that has passed since, 80 years, is nothing in historical terms, that is impossible. So basically what you have to do is to tell the story. To tell the story or the stories in as many ways as we can, innovative ways, engaging ways, original ways, adapted to the audience ways. And to tell the story means an educational curriculum, and it means an exhibition, and it means a book, and it means an audiovisual presentation, and an Instagram account, our VR presentation, a virtual reality presentation. Those of them are ways to tell the story. But we need to do there are two preconditions to our ability to do this. We have to be in solid moral ground, factual ground. We cannot be charlatans. We cannot just, you know, to spread. We have to know exactly what the story is. So that's the reason we continue to invest so much in gathering documentation. And the second is research that converts that data into knowledge. And then when we know what happened and we analyze what happened, then we can tell the story in a responsible way.
I'm glad you mentioned marketing just now, because at the very end of this podcast, we come to a sort of commercial break, and I would like your assistance in doing it, because I'd like to ask you, what is the importance of the work of the Freundeskreis, and why do you think one should become a member of it?
You mentioned it. When we speak about the Shoah, Germany is like none other country. You cannot compare the significance, the importance, the relevance of Shoah commemoration in Germany to that in any other country. Yad Vashem goes global. We intend to be present, even probably physically, around the world. It will not be tomorrow morning, but it will take some time. And even if we do that, the grassroots activity must be made by locals. And the fact that in Germany such a really a remarkable group of people, Kai Dickmann became also a personal friend, are so engaged and so committed and so persistent in their work for Holocaust remembrance. And the project in Kiel was one example, now the Bundestag event, etc. It's invaluable. And I think that, you know, is the responsibility of decent Germans to be engaged in the Freudenkreis. I must also say it has also financial significance too. I don't see it as the most important. Probably in other places I see the fundraising arm of our societies in the world as more important. Here is the values of the following crisis are the important thing. The engagement of regular Germans in remembering what happened by Germany 80 years ago, I think it's important for Germany, you know, less than for Yad Vashem and for Israel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very, very much. Vielen, vielen Dank for being part of this podcast and sharing your insights, a lot of personal insights as well, and our very best wishes for your future work. Thank you.
Thank you so much.